If you think for a moment about teachers you've had in your life, now for some of you, that's, you know, going on right now. Some of you, that's way, way back. And think about who your favorite teachers are or were. And think about what made them or makes them a good teacher. What is it that really connects with you? When I think about someone that I've had over the years and the past, usually it was somebody who knew their stuff. They knew their stuff, but they were able to teach it in a way that you could get a hold of it. You know, there's some people, maybe you had a teacher, you could tell they were brilliant, but if you weren't brilliant too, there was a disconnect. But they had a way of taking complex ideas and just helping you kind of wrap your mind around them and understand it, and so you could apply it and use it as you needed to. But there was a third element too, and that is there's a sense that they cared about you not only as a student but as a person. And there was a connection there, and you sense that they wanted you to succeed. They wanted you to do well. They wanted you not just to get this information that they were providing for you, but to live your life well. We have in Jesus, as we consider him and try to know fully as much as we're able to who he is and what he did, we want to look this morning at this aspect of him as a teacher. That Jesus was a teacher, and he was a master teacher. He had a way of teaching things in a way that just blow the world apart. And things, and people who don't even follow him will still connect with what he had to say. So let's look at that. What we're going to do this morning is, you kind of, if you're following along in the outline, you'll see what we're going to look at is some of the methods that he looked at, and then what he also tried to convey to us. So how he did it, and then what he tried to convey. One of the things that we look at when we look through the Gospels, we begin to see is that Jesus taught in a variety of locations. Jesus didn't have a classroom. He didn't set up and say, here's my building, here's my college, my university, and everybody come here and learn from me. Jesus went around Israel. He went north of Israel. He went up. He was spent a lot of time up in the Galilee area and what's beyond that, known as the Decapolis. And then he would work his way down from time to time, down the Jordan River or through Samaria and down into Judea where Jerusalem was. And as he's traveling and he's going through places, he would teach. And he taught in places like mountainsides. The beginning of Matthew chapter 5 says he went up, there was a crowd there, and he took disciples, they went up on a mountainside, and he began to teach there. He taught in synagogues. That may be a new word for you, but a synagogue is a little bit kind of like a church. There was the temple in Jerusalem, and you went there every so often, but the synagogues were usually in a town, a village, a city, wherever, and they were even outside in the Roman world, wherever there were Jews living, enough of them to kind of come together and get a space, and that's where they would read the word, be praying, and that's where they learned things there. Jesus taught in the temple courts. And go to the temple, if you study and you look at it, you know, it's got all of these different, there's the, you know, the places where the sacrifices were made, but then there are also all these courts kind of surrounding it and in these different areas, and Jesus would go there and people would gather around and he would teach there. And sometimes he taught just as he's walking from point A to B and pointing out things to people. And you can imagine him, you know, he's walking along and it's harvest time and they're walking through and you can see that it's getting ready for harvest. And Jesus is able to say, look, you know, there's going to be a harvest of souls just as there is a harvest of plants. Jesus even taught from a boat. There was such a crowd coming in on him. He was down by the Sea of Galilee. He got on a boat, and what that did, gave him a little bit of distance, but then it also amplified, because, you know, if you get around water, it has a way of raising the volume, and the sound carries. So he did all of this. And here's something that we want to see about that teaching. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, we read this. When Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority, not as their teachers of the law. The teachers of the law would cite all sorts of different people, but Jesus just came in and spoke with authority. He taught with authority. He wasn't passing along some information. He wasn't reading all these other books and then saying, okay, now let me tell you, let me summarize what I've read and what I've learned. But instead he did it this way. We see it in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5. It says, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago. This is Jesus speaking. But I tell you. It says that you've heard this, but I tell you. How can he do that? How can he claim himself as the priori source, the ultimate source? Well, because he was the ultimate source. He was the original source. John 1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. He was the one who spoke everything into existence. He's the one who knows how it's all supposed to work. If you were having trouble with a car and you're trying to figure it out and you had two people to choose from, one of them is me and the other one is somebody who, an engineer who designed the car, particularly that area that you are having trouble with, who are you going to listen to? Hopefully you're going to listen to the other person. Because they know they were there at the very beginning. And so Jesus is able to come in because he is God and in the beginning was God. And so he's able to be that original source and speak with authority. Why does that matter? Because we have to ask ourselves every time we come into a moral choice, will I listen to Jesus or not? Will I trust his words or not? And if I ask myself, well, why should I trust his words? Then I come back to this authority, because he is the authority on this. This Jesus, another way that he taught was he used something called hyperbole, which are outrageous examples, exaggerations, or shocking statements designed to get your attention, designed to make you go, what? What did he just say? How could that be? Jesus said something like, you know, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to get into heaven. You go, wait, what now? And you start seeing this camel and you start seeing a little eye of a needle. And you say, how does that work? How does that fit? I don't know how that works. Oh, it must be very hard if we're clinging on to our wealth. Now, these statements are not meant to be taken literally, but they definitely get the point across. Let me give you an example. It's in Matthew chapter 5. Jesus speaking says, you've heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you, there it is, one of those. I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now, obviously, Jesus doesn't want us to mutilate ourselves. Because after a while, you know, sinful as we are, we wouldn't have any eyes or hands or feet or anything else. What he's making a point here is how seriously we need to take our faith and the steps that we must take in order to fully surrender ourselves to him. So a modern idea might be, if you're struggling with pornography and it's easy for you to get on your computer at home, then maybe you don't have a computer at home. Or maybe you don't have a smartphone, you just have a flip phone. Because you recognize there's a weakness there. And instead of trying to wrestle through and think, oh, I can do it, you just say, no, I need to make some drastic choices. And in doing so, what he's doing, and using hyperbole, he's teaching us on life in the kingdom. He's teaching us on life in the kingdom, what it is to live in life. In fact, if you go through Matthew 5, 6, and 7, that's what you're going to get. It's kind of a primer on what does it mean to live in the kingdom of heaven. Oftentimes, we have this idea that the kingdom of heaven is this thing we're going to go to someday. And there is the promise of heaven. But the Gospels really teach us is that the kingdom of heaven is coming to us. Jesus is ushering it in, and as it takes hold in each heart, in each mind, the kingdom grows. And so what we have to learn is how to live in that kingdom. Now, if you were to go and suddenly find yourself spending a year or two in another country, very different than ours, or even somewhat similar, but different enough, you'd find yourself having to learn a few things, wouldn't you? You'd have to kind of pick up some things like, how people cook food, the flavors they put in it. That might be a little bit different. You kind of figure out, what the value people put on different things and such. You find out in some countries, we here in the U.S., we're very tied to the clock. If you say you're going to be somewhere, at 9 o'clock, you're supposed to be there at 9 o'clock or call ahead or send a text or something saying I'm running late or I'm not going to be there after all. But you go to a lot of places in the world, time is very fluid. And people say, we'll be there at 9. They may mean 11. And in their culture, they're not worried. When they show up, they show up and everybody's okay with that. Nobody's mad or offended except the Westerners who are running by the clock. And so there are these values, this way of doing things that matter to them. We here in the U.S. and the Western culture, we like our personal space. You go in some place of the world, they're right here. Not because they're rude, but that's just how they do it. And so you have to learn those values and what it's like to live over there so you're not going against their cultural norms and such. And so what we begin to see is that Jesus is showing that this is what life is like to be a citizen in the kingdom of heaven. These are the values. These are the things that are important. These are the things you should do or not do if you're going to be considered a citizen of this kingdom. If you're looking to try to understand that, go to Matthew 5, 6, and 7 this week and just spend a little time in there and see that. And you'll see some basic things like, watch your mouth. Be careful what you say. Don't insult people. Or if you've got a break in your relationship, do everything possible to fix it as soon as possible. And if you've sinned, own your sin just as quickly as you can. And don't go around making elaborate oaths on things. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Keep your commitments. Love even your enemies. Those are the types of things that he says. Things that we need to begin to incorporate into our lives in the kingdom. Another way that Jesus taught was he used visual illustrations. He used visual illustrations. Let me give you a couple examples here. It says in Matthew 18, at that time the disciples came to Jesus and asked, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And he called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And he said, truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Understand, in their mindset in that time, children, you had to kind of grow into your value. And here's Jesus, in order to make his point, he could just say it, but instead he grabs his little child and says, okay, stand here. And so they're all seeing it, and they're all thinking and feeling and everything that they do about what it means to be a kid. And so now you've got to become like this. And they're able to connect with it in a deeper way. And I sometimes wonder if this little kid later years in life, I don't know about you, but Jesus used me as an object lesson once. But they're all able to look at this and go, become a kid again. Everybody's telling me grow up. You're telling me don't. And so they have to think about it, and it's challenging to some of the assumptions that they might have. Here's another one. In John 13, Jesus has entered in, again, we're going to have the Passover, and no one has washed any feet. And so Jesus does it. It says, when he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. Do you understand what I've done for you? You call me teacher. You call me Lord. And rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly, I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. And what he's doing here is he taught on the very nature of the kingdom, what the kingdom is like. Now, one of the things that we saw, remember, they were all asking themselves, who's going to be great in the kingdom? Who's going to be great? Who's going to be at your side? They have a sense that things are coming to a climax. Jesus is going to reveal himself as the Messiah. He's going to kick out Rome. He's going to establish a kingdom as great as like David once had. And they're all kind of jockeying for position. Who's going to be his right-hand man? Who's going to be one of his lieutenants? Who's going to be great in this kingdom? Just saying, you've got it all wrong, guys. That is not how my kingdom works. Yes, in men's kingdoms, in human kingdoms, people want to be great. So you want to be great? You got to be last. You got to be a servant. He's teaching here that the kingdom is a place of humility, like a child. And it's a place of servanthood, like washing feet. And Jesus taught over and over things like, you know, if you want to be first, go to the back of the line. You want to be great, become a servant. You want to live, you got to die to yourself. And he uses these visual illustrations to help make his point and to make it memorable to hang on to. Another way he taught, it says in Mark 4:2, that he taught many things by parables. Jesus used stories and parables to help people understand things. A parable is basically a story. It takes kind of an earthly experience and lays it next to a heavenly experience or understanding. Why do that? Well, we need a reference point to grasp things that we've never experienced. If someone, you know, you were visiting, say, down in Texas, and somebody said, hey, would you like some rattlesnake? I don't know. What's it taste like? A little bit like gopher snake. You know, well, that doesn't help at all unless you've had gopher snake. I've never had either. But if someone said, it tastes like chicken. Oh, well, okay. Yeah, I'll try that. We need something to connect, some experience over here that we've had so we can grasp something that we've never had. And none of us have had the kingdom of heaven. So he gives us some similes, it's like this. So it's like something here that we have experienced so we can understand something over here that we haven't. And what a story does is it paints a picture in our mind and then connects with us at an emotional level, and it helps drive the point home even more so. You can tell somebody outright something, but a story will somewhat, you know, involve you a little bit. You know that after Bambi came out, way back when, the applications for deer licenses went down. Because who wants to go out and shoot Bambi's mom? Now, people obviously got over it. But, you know, that first connection there is like, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing? Let me give you three quick examples of how Jesus did this. In Luke 15, we read that the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and he eats with them." So then Jesus told them this parable, and he actually tells three altogether. The first one he tells is of a shepherd who has lost a sheep. A sheep has wandered off. And so he leaves the others behind, and he goes out and goes on a hunt, and he goes on a search, and he finds that lost sheep, and he brings it back and calls everybody together, and let's celebrate over this lost sheep that's now back. And then he tells a story about a woman, a widow, who's lost a coin. She only has so many coins, and I mean, this is what she has to live on. She's not getting a, you know, social security check, you know, next month, so she's just got to get through. This is it. And she's lost this coin. So she cleans her house. She sweeps and goes over, and she's doing everything. You've done this, looking for your TV remote. You know, she's going crazy looking for this. And she finally finds the coin and calls everybody together. Hey, celebrate with me. Because this was lost and now it's found. And he takes it one more step. And he tells a story of a son. He told his dad essentially, I wish you were dad because, you know, I want my inheritance now. And so father gives him the inheritance. Son goes off, invests it wisely, builds a house for his dad to come and live in. You know that story, right? Then he goes off, blows it. Loses it all. A famine hits. All the friends that he had when he had money are now gone. And the best job that this nice Jewish boy can get is tending to pigs, which he wasn't supposed to be around or eat or anything. I mean, he's bottom level. And he's looking at what the pigs eat. He's looking at what the pigs eat and says, that looks good. Wish I had some. And then something happens in his mind. He begins to think about, you know, as we do, think about the good old days, and begins, you know what? The people who worked for my dad had it pretty good. They had shelter, they had a place to sleep, they had a roof over their head, they had food every day. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to my dad, and I bet if I make a case about how sorry I am, he'll and just ask him just for a job. I just want to be one of your servants in your house. Just that's enough. That'll be enough. As long as I can eat and have a roof over my head, I'll be okay. And so he begins to make his way back home. And I'm sure he's just rehearsing that speech. You know, he really wants to get every word right because he's really got to hope his dad has some mercy on him and will let him have this place. And as he goes over that final crest before his house, his dad, who I'm sure is scanning on a regular basis the horizon, sees a silhouette. And as he's watching it come closer, I know that walk anywhere. It's my son. I thought he was dead. He's coming home. I wonder what he's going to say. I'm going to hear him out because I don't know if I really want him to come back. Does that happen? No. Jesus said the man ran. He ran to his son. And the son is trying to get out the speech that he's memorized and prepared. He can barely get it out, and the dad just picks him up in a big old bear hug and hugs him. And then he says, get this man a coat, get him shoes, get him a ring. And while you're at it, I want you to go kill the fattened calf. We're going to party tonight. Because the son of mine who was lost is now found. The son of mine who was dead is now alive. And he uses those three parables to teach us on the value of people and the very nature of grace itself. You see, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they had no value of the people that Jesus was teaching, that were people who were coming to Jesus. And Jesus said, these people have value. And the fact that they're coming back to the kingdom is something to celebrate. And so he's saying, this is what grace is. Grace doesn't wait for the speech. Grace doesn't cross its arms and say, prove yourself to me. Grace just envelops you and says, welcome home. Youngest daughter and youngest granddaughter visiting right now. And the youngest granddaughter is just a little over one, walking like they do, you know, just kind of like they're drunk. Just And I was giving my daughter a hug this morning. Little granddaughter comes up like, "Hey, I want some of that." So I looked at her and I said, "I don't think so. I'm going to need some good grades before I give you hugs." "No." I swooped her up, "Come on up here. We're going to have a hug sandwich. You get in here." And that's what God does. He sees you and he says, "Come here. If you're coming home, you're welcome home." That's what grace does. Another way that Jesus taught was he asked questions. Questions are good because they get you thinking. And they kind of demand an answer. And so the audience says, "Okay, if that's the question, what's the answer?" And Jesus in Luke 14 says, "So suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it?" And you, people go, "Well, let me think about that." Now, maybe you've not built a tower, but you might think, "I'm going to build a home, or I'm going to buy a home. Can I afford the monthly payments?" Yeah, you've been there. You count the cost. And so what did he do there? He taught on the cost of discipleship, that following him, though he welcomes us home, he says, "Look, you come in, but you're coming in like a child. And are you ready? You'll learn, you'll struggle, you'll fall down, but are you ready to follow along here?" Jesus didn't just ask questions, he also answered them. Matthew 22, we read about the Sadducees who didn't believe in a resurrection. They were trying to trip Jesus up with a question. And so they proposed a scenario to him. And they said, "There was a man in our that we knew," and maybe they were just making that part up, but said, "You know, he got married, then he died. And Moses said, now what we need to do is another brother needs to marry him. If she doesn't have any kids, another next brother in line needs to marry her. So hopefully they'll have kids and raise up a name for himself and a lineage there. But before that happens, that brother died. And then she marries the next brother, and that brother dies, and that brother dies. And it goes through seven brothers. Nobody seemed to stop and ask the question, what's this wife serving them? Because it sounds like she should be on one of my wife's Forensic Files episodes. No, they think they've got it, and they say, okay, now, at the resurrection, which they don't believe is going to happen, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? You can just say, huh? We got you now, Jesus, huh? How are you going to answer that one? And Jesus replied, "You're in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven." So basically saying, guys, whatever is like here, it's just going to be so different. You don't even understand the nature of heaven. And so what he's doing in answering this question, he's teaching something. Well, here's another one. Matthew 24, Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, "Tell us, when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age?" And what you can imagine what they're doing. They're there in Jerusalem and they're so impressed with everything. And Jesus said, "Guys, this is all coming down." Well, when? When? And Matthew 24, he gives them a few things and basically says, you know, you're never really going to know for sure. But then he gets to Matthew 25 and he tells them three more parables. He tells a parable of the 10 virgins, because what happened, you know, we're very bride-centric. They were groom-centric. And when the wedding, a man would propose, then he'd go back, get her house ready, and get a room ready, kind of on his dad's place, add a room on there, and then he'd come back. And you never knew when he was going to come back, and usually it was late at night. It was kind of a little game they play. And what you had to do when you thought it was coming, you would go out with your oil and in your lamp, and you'd wait up all night until he came back, and then you'd go in with the processional. But if you didn't take enough oil, if you ran out of oil, you didn't have a candle anymore to light, and you couldn't be part of the processional. So he basically said you need to be prepared. And then he said, it's also like a master went off on a trip and he brought in three servants and he gave the first one 10 bags of gold, another one 5 bags, or 10 pieces of gold, 5 pieces of gold, 1 piece of gold, and said, okay, go invest it, make it happen. And the first one doubled it. Second one doubled it. Third one took it and buried it in the ground. And then one day the master showed back up again and said, okay, let's give accounts. And when he found out the third one had just buried it, he took him to task. And then the third parable that he told, he said, you know, it's going to be like when the Son of Man comes back, the king is going to call everybody together. It's going to be like a shepherd separating the sheep and the goats and the righteous and the unrighteous. And what will be the difference is how people treated the least of these. So what's he doing here? He's teaching on the nature of heaven, what heaven is going to be like. And then he's teaching how to be ready for it. Because you don't know when the master will show up. But live as if that could be today. But here's the most important thing to understand about our master teacher. He lived what he preached. He practiced what he preached. He lived out what he taught. He taught us to put ourselves last, to be a servant. He was a servant. He taught us to pick up our cross and die to ourselves. He picked up his cross and he died to himself. He didn't ask us to do what he wasn't willing to do. And so this morning, consider the master teacher. Consider Jesus. If he's new to you, keep looking. Keep learning. If you've kind of gotten used to him, look again. Listen again. But here's his ultimate call to you and I. Will we follow him? And this morning, if you're ready to follow him for the first time, or to renew that following, you need to know that the arms of grace are open wide. He says, come on. It's not going to be easy, but I will love you through the journey. I just ask you to just keep coming back to me. Keep learning from me. Just keep coming back. Trust in me. If you fall down, I'll help you get back up. If you have trouble with belief, I'll help you in your unbelief. But just keep coming back to me. This morning as we sing the song, if you're ready to follow him, to be buried in the waters of baptism, raised to a new life, we invite you to do that. If you're already an immersed person and you want to be a part of this congregation and join with us on this journey, we invite you to do that. Or if you just need to come up and use these steps like a place to pray, an altar, we invite you to do that. Whatever you need, whatever you sense him prompting you, listen to that still small voice. Let's pray. Father God, I thank you for this morning and an opportunity for us right now just to let you work in us, let you move us, let you just push us in the direction that you want us to go as you just sweep us up like that father with his son. Welcome us. Transform us. Move us. And I pray this now in Jesus' name. Amen.